Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an allied healthcare professional with over 25 years of experience. My career has primarily spanned private physical therapy and public school athletics. Driven by curiosity and a passion for the industry, I created the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast to explore the ever-evolving landscape of healthcare with a focus on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we'll dive into the challenges healthcare professionals encounter and discuss how collaboration can enhance understanding within the industry. Our goal is to improve the experience for patients and athletes alike. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, I'd like to welcome Dr. Charles Thigpen. Dr. Thigpen is a Senior Vice President of Clinical Excellence for ATI Physical Therapy, leading clinical practice standards, development, and innovation across the ATI platform to prevent and treat of musculoskeletal disorders. Dr. Thigpen holds adjunct appointments at Duke University's Department of Orthopedics in the Division of Physical Therapy, the University of South Carolina Department of Physical Therapy, and Clemson University's Bioengineering Department. Chuck completed his PhD in Human Movement Science from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in 2006. He completed an MS in Human Movement Science with a concentration in Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy from UNC in May of 2003. He earned his BS in Physical Therapy from East Tennessee State University in 1997. Chuck played football for the University of Tennessee Chattanooga in 1991 and 1992 before becoming a student athletic trainer through 1995. Today, he leads the clinical service and care innovation aimed to deliver predictable outcomes while bending the cost curve for patients with MSK-related pain. He leads the clinical quality improvement and benchmarking for ATI's patient outcome registries, which is the largest in physical therapy with over 3.3 million individual patient episodes. He has been funded by the MIT Research Endeavor and Foundation for Physical Therapy for health innovation and development of clinical pathways for orthopedic-related pain. He has over 800 peer-reviewed scientific papers published in leading scientific journals, including Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, American Journal of Sports Medicine, Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, Journal of Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy, and the British Journal of Sports Medicine, and his work has been cited more than 1,000 times. Chuck is an NATA BOC certified athletic trainer and a member of the National Athletic Trainers Association, American Academy of Orthopedics and Sports Physical Therapy, American Shoulder and Elbow Society, American Society of Shoulder and Elbow Surgeons, and the ICCUS Society of Sports Rehabilitation. He served as the research chair for the American Academy of Sports Physical Therapy from 2012 to 2018 and as president of the American Society of Shoulder and Elbow Therapists from 2010 to 2012. Dr. Thigpen received the 2008 Founders Award for service to the American Society of Shoulder and Elbow Therapists. In 2012, he was awarded the APTA Academy of Sports PT Lynn Wallace Award for clinical education and mentoring in recognition for his contributions to sports physical therapy in the areas of teaching and mentoring, and in 2022, the Clinical Excellence Award for career contributions to sports PT research. In 2015, Chuck was inducted as an inaugural member of the East Tennessee State University's College of Clinical and Rehabilitative Health Sciences Alumni Hall of Fame. Now, on to the show. Everybody, welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine podcast this week. This week, I have Dr. Chuck Thigpen, Senior Vice President of Clinical Excellence for ATI Physical Therapy. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Can you give the listeners a little background about you, where you started, your brief education background, and then, you know, clinically where you're at?
Sure. No, happy to do it. So I have been an athletic trainer for 30, this is my 31st year, physical therapist for 28. So I'm now getting the other side. I'm not like you. I'm not nice and peppered. I'm just shiny. But I was in an internship athletic training program, University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, early 90s. Physical therapy degree at East Tennessee State University in 1996. And then started working outpatient PT. I worked in clinics in the Knoxville, Tennessee area, opened some clinics for way back what used to be physiotherapy associates, did sideline coverage and that kind of stuff. And then early 2000s, I went to the University of North Carolina, started, I was in their master's sports physical therapy program, got a chance to work with a number of teams there, was interim athletic, head women's athletic trainer for a couple of years, for 04 and 05, or maybe 03 and 04. It's 20 years ago now.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it was great, great experience. Love working at high level athletics, and then got the research bug and really worked on a couple of large projects. One measuring jump landings at the military academies was much of my, but I wasn't a knee guy. I actually got really interested in the shoulder, and so started scapular kinematics and biomechanics and throwing stuff and got really interested. And then towards the very end of my PhD, I took an epidemiology and public health course on clinical trials. Started thinking about outcomes and how do we measure if patients get better. And I turned my attention from biomechanics and really what was the core of my PhD to outcomes and patient assessment. And honestly, I joke, I'm actually into my 18th year of being a recovering biomechanist. I love all that stuff. I love all the tech and labs. And probably early, my vision was to bring the lab to the clinic. And I think now what I realize, most of the gaps in how we're taking care of patients is we don't even know if the basic stuff works, right? Like I'll use a discussion I had with some folks from your neighborhood in the last few weeks. Like, how do we measure strength? I don't know. Do we know if increasing strength even measures outcomes? I have no idea. There's very little data that actually shows. We know for ACL, like, right, I take your bailiwick, right? Like, we know for ACL patients, if your quad gets stronger, it's less injury, and you have a higher functional score. But we don't know how many visits that, like, is that 2 weeks or 20 visits, or does it just happen in time? So it's just really interesting when you really look at what I'll think about as clinical data, what happens. So anyway, it's a little bit of my history. And so currently I've been with ATI a long time. The last 3 years I've served over our clinical excellence department. So there's three buckets with clinical excellence at ATI. One's our best practice standards and quality improvement. Ellen Shanley leads that work. Our clinical development, including the Institute for Musculoskeletal Advancement, Tom Dinninger leads that. So that's all of our residency, fellowships, CEUs, in-house courses, and then all the research we do across the platform. And then I have the innovation group. So Mac Winkler leads that work, which is primarily our digital pieces. So our digital HEP, remote therapeutic monitoring and telehealth, and then with a heavy dose of value-based care. So that's kind of my bucket and bailiwick. And I have a ball every day getting up, trying to figure out things in each of those verticals.
It's pretty amazing. And I think this is one of the reasons why I wanted to have you come on the show is because of your expertise, your level of experience, and then, you know, outcome data we talk about all the time. And that's what really drives what we do every day and how we provide great care for patients. So that's our big focus today, is to discuss that and evidence-based practice. So with that, we look at evidence-based practice. How does it shape our practice as ATI? What are you seeing and what do we have to look forward to in the future?
Yeah, you know, I think about when I first came. So ATI acquired the practice I was with in 2015. And one of the things that they had just started doing just right before we were acquired was collecting outcomes data as a standard part of practice. And so now we're actually in our 10th year of collecting. Every patient gets a baseline measure. We've got a consistent set of outcomes where they actually measure what we think they do is a whole other topic for another day. But at least as best we can, we've been consistently doing that. And I'm really proud that, you know, right now, as we said today, 75% of patients across ATI have a beginning and end outcome. So I know what their level of disability or their level of function was when they start, and I know how much better they got. So we've been able to leverage that to actually understand how we do in different areas and what good looks like and really build that. So I think when I think about that, just knowing that piece allows us now to start to improve. How do we actually make clinical care better as opposed to you know, I think a lot of times I joke in sports medicine, PT, athletic training, we're way overeducated. We've got lots of letters behind our names. We know lots of stuff, but not a lot of evidence to suggest that any of that actually helps patients get better, athletes get back on the court.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I was talking to a good friend of mine who runs a spine clinic down in Shreveport, Louisiana. He's actually the vice president of outpatient practice for Willis Knighton Healthcare Systems. And he said that exact same thing. He's like, just because you have a bunch of letters at the end of the name doesn't mean the outcomes are where they need to be with patient care. So we have to collect more data. We have to make sure that we're doing that. And one thing I mentioned to my staff here is that, you know, if you're waiting for the outcomes to be able to populate on your EMR every sixth visit, and you're not collecting that final outcome at visit 13 because they're getting discharged, you're not collecting all that data. So I think that's the big thing that we have to do as clinicians is to make sure we keep that on our radar to help make that 75% turn into 100%. Right.
Yeah, no, look, the only places I know that do better than we are today, there are places that require every time you walk in the door, you get an outcome measure. That's a lot, right? And they get 98%. So I think really, it really hits on probably, if I cast a vision forward of what in my head will evolve to, I love the single alphanumeric evaluation tool, the SANE score, just how are you doing today, 0 to 100% for the body region we're taking care of. So if I was taking care of your shoulder, hey, Andrew, how are you today? How's your shoulder 0 to 100%? Or 100% you're normal. It's not perfect, but it's one question. And I could do that every visit. We do that. Most clinicians do that in some type of a way every time a patient walks in the door, right? Hey, how you doing today? So that I think probably has the potential to do that. We're actually doing some work looking at it across all of our patients. And, you know, the benefit of seeing 25,000 patients a day across 900 clinics is doesn't take long to get a nice sample. And so it looks like it holds up pretty well. And what's interesting is it actually measures something different than the standardized scores do. It's similar, right? If you're going up and to the right, getting better, they get better at the same rate, but they're not exactly the same if you really start teasing out, in particular when you look at post-operative patients returning to sport. So we looked at adolescent athletes. I'll give you two little nuggets of things we've been poking around in. One is in patients with shoulder instability. So patients with shoulder instability that we ask, hey, how are you 0 to 100% before return to sport testing? And then we put them through about an hour-long battery, standard strength, range of motion, those kind of things. Did the closed kinetic chain upper extremity tap test, and then did some advanced overhead work as described by Margie Olds and AJSM in 21, kind of this more dynamic testing. So it's some weighted balls, some throwing and stuff at the end. So on average, the instability kid said, hey, I'm a 92. I'm just right there ready to go back. After we tested them, almost 70% back there. Like, oh, just yeah. Kidding. All right, so I think it's what I think I am into my mind versus the other. So I think it's really interesting. And then we saw a similar thing in throwing athletes, young adolescent throwers. You could ask them, and it's interesting. They tracked and got better. But when you said, hey, are you ready to go back to sport? Pain seemed to give, I'll hesitate of saying better, a different representation of their ability to go back to sport compared to standard tool. So I think it brings in, I like it because it's simple. It's one, you do that on every patient, and it seems to give us a different perspective on how patients are improving.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great way for us to, you know, keep on top of, you know, again, how patients are doing. That being said, how do we leverage that when it comes to, you know, if we look at where PT is going as far as payer mix reimbursement, how do we leverage outcomes? How does that work towards not even just ATI, but other physical therapy around?
We're actually working really closely with other large therapy groups and the APTA to look at. So the merit-based incentive payment system was put in place when the ACA came out in 2009. Physical therapists could start participating in 19, and we've used that. And so if you see a certain volume of outpatient PT, Medicare Part B, you're required by law to report. There's some other details, but really now taking that, we've been reporting for 4 or 5 years. We've consistently always reported, been really fortunate. We've always scored really high. But now as other practices are, that's becoming the standard measure set. And so a number of large practices, Intermountain Healthcare, we worked with CMS and other outcome groups, some folks at WebPT and Limber, kind of land on what's known as MSK measure 1, 2, 3, 4, super complex, titling, but really where you can use validated outcomes to look at all the body regions. And if you do that and leverage risk adjustment, now that's your measure of quality. So I say that then sets up for our ability therapists, if they report and meet the reporting, and if you are in a higher benchmark, you can get a bonus. And that's the first time for me that I've ever been, hey, if you get patients better, there's an opportunity financially with that. So we're beginning to see that. The other way we're seeing it is in large accountable care organizations, which primarily are Medicare and Medicare Advantage population health programs administered by other commercials, will partner and leverage quality outcomes, whether it's falls risk assessment, reducing falls plans, or quality outcomes to do that. So I think we're just on the tip of moving from fee-for-service to value-based within PT, or especially orthopedic PT, but I think we're getting there, where now that there's emerging evidence that not only does early PT save dollars, but if you get a patient better, that saves dollars. So now you're beginning to the spot that, you know, you can get to justify, hey, I get patients more better, and by doing that, be reimbursed for that. But it's really in the early stages. It's a little more than nascent. So we've been fortunate to do some of that. We worked with other providers. I had a chance to sit with the American Orthopedic PT Group. So the Academy of Ortho PT is doing a lot of work with a private practice session to advocate around these areas to, you know, rightly reimburse PTs for the value we bring to the healthcare system.
Yeah, I mean, that's great to know, because I think a lot of people are frustrated with fee for service because it's so fluctuating up and down month over month. And
well, it's not fluctuating. It only goes one direction.
It goes down.
Right. I think you think about it, like there's another 3% cut on the books for 25. And Medicare, if that goes through, it'll be almost a 15% cut in Medicare rates since 2020. Right. I mean, I forget that we haven't had a CPT increase since I started, by the way, which is a really long time. I mean, it's actually gone the other direction. So I think as CMS, federal government looks in the challenges, right, that all flows to the other payers, right? All in general, Medicare is the benchmark for how we're paid.
Yeah, and I mean, with Medicare, we know that the population is aging more and more and more, right? So, and they're the bigger population that we're dealing with, especially in my community. And it's unfair that they can't get, or we're not getting what we need to be able to do to be able to provide the care for them.
Yeah, it's not sustainable for sure.
Can you explain, I mean, you talked about MIPS. Can you explain a little bit more for people that don't understand what it is? And even, you know, the QPP program and how that works?
The quality payment program in MIP. MIPS is one of the quality payment programs that you can participate in, essentially for physical therapists. If you're in the general commercial world that are seeing, you know, Medicare patients, you can either be in an APM, so an advanced payment model. Those are generally large healthcare systems or networks. You can be in an ACO, or you can meet the MIPS requirement. In each of those, there's really four buckets. So there's quality measures, comes sometimes it's some of the old PQRS measures for those who've been around a while, falls risk, falls planning. And what you see is in the beginning, you get credit for example, reporting BMI, you'd get a check mark if you just reported, because they knew the first step was to report. Well, now everybody gets 99.9% on that, so they don't give you any bonus for that. So same thing with falls risk. 5 years ago, you could get credit for doing a falls risk assessment. Now you have to actually provide evidence that you gave a falls risk plan and did something about it. So I think it starts to flow along those ways. And then outcomes, as we described, essentially risk-adjusted outcomes, beginning and end of care. If you can demonstrate you're meeting a risk-adjusted benchmark at a certain level, there's a bonus. And then the other two pieces that are coming that are different, beginning this year, your EMR has to meet interoperability requirements, which means that the Basically, the patient has to be able to see their medical records. You have to be able to connect. You don't have to do it because it takes another party, but you have to have the IT standards within your data structure to connect to other organizations. And then you have to be measuring patient satisfaction. So I think those are some interesting interoperability requirements. And then soon what you'll begin to see is cost. It's the fourth pillar of value-based payment. So there's quality assessment, improvement activities, interoperability, and the last is cost. It looks like there's going to be cost standards that'll come out. So for example, for a total knee, a patient's had a total knee. This is your cost benchmark and probably measured in visits, right? If you're within that, then you're good. If you go over that, you'll actually get a penalty. So you get paid for the visit, but it'll be at a lower rate. So I think that's sort of, we kind of look at what they've done in other areas, that's likely how they'll approach that, but it's kind of walking in. So we've got three of the four components, and we would think in the next few years, it'll grow into the fourth component, including cost expectations.
Great if it does, because we've been waiting for a long time, right? It's been this.
Well, yeah, I mean, be careful what you ask for, right? But I think you'll begin to see value, true value, right? What's the amount, a degree of outcome improvement or satisfaction for the cost of the service? And look, I think, you know, if you think about just simple math, my kids are getting ready to start back to school. We were talking is the denominator always has the bigger influence on the fraction. And so if you can shift cost and bend the cost curve, which we no PT can, that gives us a really good chance to demonstrate value. And I think that's, you know, that's why I'm so robust on what the value we bring in healthcare.
Do you think that value has had an influence on the PT hiring or the supply and demand? Because that's one of the things we're trying to wrap our heads about, right? And it's
yeah,
like,
you know, it's an odd, weird and odd place for PT. I look back when I first got out, my first job was around 30K. So I got paid in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And I was just glad to be an outpatient, right? There are way more PTs wanted to be an outpatient than there were jobs. I think where we are now, we are seeing a pivot. You mentioned the aging population. I think more and more, you know, large primary care groups, all these ACOs are seeing value of physical therapy and seeing that there's more patients. So I think we're at this interesting precipice of, wait a minute, there's not enough PTs. What are we going to do? And so the only answer is to increase the supply, right? So I think, you know, as we work to do that, I think we're going to be in a pinch for probably 5 years at least until some drastic changes are made about how we train PTs, how we license and credential them, and how we pay them. Look, right now, you've got to be able to get your education in a cost-effective way, or it's really difficult to justify as a young PT coming out. I mean, you know, just, you know, if I look at, hey, would you, for $150,000 in debt, you want to be a PT, a PA, or a nurse practitioner? There's only two of those three make sense financially, one of the three don't. And that's just a return on investment, right? Like, I think about my kids, I got a 16-year-old starting to look at colleges, and we sit down, I'm like, hey, this is how this works, right? This is what mom and dad are going to help you with. This is what we expect you to do. You got to have a little skin in the game at our house. And how are we going to do that? And all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, why would I do that? Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So I think it's a real challenge. I mean, as a random side note, right? I know you're an athletic trainer too. Like, that's how I look at athletic training. It's hard to make the math work for a master's in athletic training right now for what the salaries are. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how healthcare responds to that. I mean, I would say it's edging on a crisis.
Yeah. And, you know, our daughter's going into her second year graduate school for speech language pathology, which I think it's good. She wanted to become a nurse, and my wife's a nurse. And my daughter just fell in love with, you know, the speech component. And for her, at least she can make it her own and could moonlight, can do, you know, outpatient practice, inpatient practice. So for her, kind of made sense. But again, the cost of education is not cheap, no matter where you go.
Nah, not cheap at all. Especially, anyway, like you, as a dad looking at it, like, oh, that hurts my feelings. It's a little better than the $21,000 it cost me for all of my undergrad and PT school. So anyway.
You and me both. I remember getting out of Northeastern, my college loans were $18,000.
Yeah, exactly.
And now Northeastern's 85-90 grand a year. So I can't justify that, you know?
Yeah, it's hard for sure.
And I made probably right around the same as you coming out of the gate. And that was generous, you know.
So, and I'm glad to have it too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Built off of that career, so which is good. When you look at you know, we talked a little bit about evidence-based practice and what that looks like. Can you define where we are as a company? I mean, we talk about this quite frequently. What's kind of our model? What's our model looking towards as far as how we use evidence-based practice so our patients get the best out of every visit they have?
Yeah, you know, I think it's when I think about when we first described what evidence-based practice is, it was, hey, take what's best for the patient, the best available evidence, and the resources the patient has. And it's all three of those things, right? So Sackett outlined it. Really, he was the first to say, he and Michael Porter from In Your Backyard, some little place called Harvard, I don't know if you ever heard. They said, hey, this is what evidence EBP is, and really talked about bringing value to patients. And so it's all three of those pieces. So when I think about that three-legged stool and where the opportunity is, I think what we see across our practice is, one, we know active care wins, right? Hands-on for sure has a role, but active care. So early active care, early access to care are the key drivers for musculoskeletal conditions improvement. So the question is, how do we do that? And I think when you look at across just kind of broadly, it's really regular. It's super scary. This is breaking news stuff here. So you've never heard this. Did you know that regular exercise helps you get better at almost anything? I've never heard it before. Yeah. Super bright. But I think I say that a lot tongue in cheek, because we know this across any health condition, right? You literally take any health condition. If you regularly exercise, as little as 1,000, increase in 1,000 steps a day improves your health outcome of diabetes, heart disease, knee OA. So now you kind of put that in a PT context. When you've got a challenge in disability, our question is, how do we get patients moving early, consistently, and better? And so the way we, if you look at the opportunity, it's actually not in the top. I'm not looking to take our best clinicians and make them super all-stars. I'm actually, and you know, I'll use our Senior Vice President of Operations, Gary Carlson's line. I'm trying to make our clinicians unbelievably average. And I think it's not a knock. It's actually, I think we lose what goes well. So it's actually, I am not a Patriots fan. I'm sorry. But I think it's okay. But look, the reason Belichick won forever besides Tom Brady was they never beat themselves. Not ever. I can literally count on my hands the 3 or 4 games that the Patriots beat themselves. They just did. You had to beat them. And so if I put that in the, that's what reducing variability in care is. And that's why standards matter. And so providing early, consistently scheduling patients, giving patients active plans of care and good doses of care, those are the key things that win. It's not because I've got magic hands. It's not because I can do some magic dry needling. It's all good stuff, but those are actually they're the dressing, right? They're the reverse. I'm in the camp of football withdrawals right now. So I'm the guy that's like logging on to watch fall. You know, they started a training camp. I'm like, hey, can I watch a little bit of training camp? This would be great. But anyway, I think about it, right. It's the reverse. It's the pass. But the reason all those things work is because they can run off tackle. They know how to blocking and tackling. So when I think about evidence-based practice, it's as much the process of care as it is the content of care. And that's it's different. I think sometimes we all get caught up in the content because we think it's a test. Our professor is going to grade us. There's one thing to know the right content, but it's just as important and maybe more important to have a consistent process of care. And so I think that's really where a lot of our focus has been. And what we've seen is when we provide early access to care, we kind of follow basic, relatively simple, basic clinical guidelines. 70% of patients get better with no other care, right? That's pretty freaking good for non-operative stuff, right? Like, that make you more than a Hall of Famer if you're playing baseball.
Yeah, and I always say it's consistency, communication, and continuity. You just have to do those things every single day. Patients get better. I had a conversation with a patient today, an older gentleman. His daughter brought him in, and he's got some, he had some congestive heart failure, but he's got some, you know, difficulties with, you know, his cardiovascular system. We're working on general strengthening. And I said to him, I'm not going to give you everything today, and it's not even going to happen over the next few weeks. The little steps you need to take here and at home, and as long as you're moving, you are going to get better. And he just looked at me and said, okay, you know, and that's one of the things we have to communicate to our patients, no matter who they are. They do little bits.
That's right.
Marathon, it's not a sprint.
No, and look, I think based on where a patient starts, right, that's a long journey. So I think when I think about evidence-based care and what it looks like, it's really having a consistent process with appropriate content of care. And the content of care is what changes, right? That's what we learn of, hey, we should do A and not B. But I think we're, in general in PT, we're over-indexed on knowledge and the content and fancy techniques and shiny objects, and maybe not quite as committed to some of that consistency and continuity of how we do things.
Yeah, I think the variability of exercise is too broad, right? I think we have to bring it more to a needle point, and we'll still see that progression that we need to see.
Yeah, for sure.
You talked a little bit about education, but not a lot. But when I go back and think about retention of employees or even bringing new people in, and this might be a discussion with Tom Denninger about this, but I think we talk about mentorship a lot, and we talk about giving the education consistently through residencies or MSK certifications. Does that set us apart from everybody else? Do you think we are providing more of that to be able to get those quality therapists in our door to work for us?
Yeah, you know, look, when I look across the platforms and different companies, you know, I think back, we were one of the first large residencies in the country in the early 2000s when I came to Greenville. We've been doing it a long time. That's not unique in and of itself anymore. Look, if there's, and it's a great thing. There's hundreds of residencies. There's lots of fellowships out there. I think when I think about that journey, though, and being able to progress it along and having some buckets to put it in, and other programs of, you know, other companies are doing it a different way, I do think what sets us apart is probably three things. One is there's a continuum. So you can come in as a new grad. We have a mentorship program. You can step into the MSK certification program, which is what I like to call our self-directed OCS. It essentially is all the content our residencies use is just at a self-directed pace of the cohort. And what's unique about that is actually leverages clinicians in your market to do mentoring and spend time with. So I think it allows young clinicians that maybe don't come with a, or even transitioning clinicians. We've had some interesting folks come from home health and inpatient, haven't been an outpatient since school, and like, hey, how do I do this? And they've been able to, you know, in a fairly 6 to 9 months kind of go from, I don't know how to do this, to, hey, I feel really comfortable. Actually, spoiler alert, we submitted an abstract to CSM. Individuals in the MSK certification program get better outcomes. So I think we're super excited about that. But I think it puts you on a progression, right, to learn together, to find that cohort. And I think it gets, you have other peers around you to help you get better. And then I think that sets up, and if you want to do a more intensive residency or fellowship, we have those opportunities. Or you may decide, hey, I'm good. I want to go do other things. We have those opportunities too. But I think especially that early career track from onboarding to mentoring to MSK cert to clinical expert, we've got a pretty good path if that's the road folks want to take. And we've been doing it a long time, right? We've been doing residency fellowships and learning stuff for 10, 15 years. And we've been able to kind of now pull that together. You know, Tom's the executive director of the Institute of MSK Advancement, and we're super excited about things we're going to do with that.
Yeah, I think it's great. You said the word career, and that's something I like to hear because, again, I was talking to my friend that I mentioned before who was in Louisiana. And he said a lot of his staff, you get people to come in and it's a job for them, but not a career. See us, an organization, and as I talked to Sharon about this, there's a lot of opportunity in this company for people to grow in clinical excellence or in leadership. So my friend had said, he goes, you know, you got to water your grass, right? You got to grow your grass. And how do you do that? You try to, you know, root yourself in your community, become better at what you're doing, get people to know who you are, your physicians, your local organizations, and that's how you become great at what you do. So my hope is that a lot of these young therapists come in and see what we can offer so we have more stable workforce and staffing that will help our patients in the long run.
I mean, I've been in PT a long time, and this is my career. It's who I am. It's what I do. And, you know, the way I think about it, I'm not taking care of patients hands-on. every day anymore, but I'm trying to find a way to equip our clinicians across the country to take care of a lot of folks and have an impact. But I think when I think about the career is, it's interesting. Sometimes we get stuck on how much you're paying me to see a patient. And I think it loses a little bit. You might as well be a technician, right? I didn't get into this to go, look, I worked on car lines, and people that are able to do that, more power to you. I could never do that. That's just not how I'm built. But if that's how you want to be paid on an hourly basis to show up and do something, we can do that. That's a different thing. So I think it's really around how do we progress along in time to do that? How do we give young therapists to see a career? Because look, I'm sure like you, I had people mentor and model for me other career things. I didn't even know I could do what I'm doing now. I had no idea when I started. If you had told me 30 years ago that I would, have an executive role with a large PT company, I would have looked at you like you had five heads, because that wasn't even a thing then,
right?
But I've been able to kind of come along and make it a career, and I think you captured that really well.
To look at, where we are as a company and how we become, I think, the leader in innovation, where do we stand as far as technology and virtual healthcare? Where do you see us going in the future? And I know we're in the process of, we have the foundation, we're building it, we're trying to make it better. Is you think that's going to set us apart and bring us to the next level in front of other organizations because we had a head start?
Yeah, I hope so. I think, look, there's a lot of people in the tech world that are doing all kinds of, the way technology is going to change how we deliver care, we are right at the forefront of it. I think about, at least for me, how we day-to-day deliver care in the four walls is zero different. I mean, it is, other than maybe shinier and smaller, like the think about the Chattanooga combo units now, they're much smaller now. But outside of that, yeah, you don't have the big inferential pad anymore, right? That you could and there's usually not diathermy units sitting around, but in general, it's not that different. Yeah, for sure. But they're not that different, right? So I think about it, and technology is going to change. It changed expectations. It's what some call the Amazon effect, right? Like, however easy Amazon is how I expect everything to be. You judge every website and every app you go to by Amazon and Apple, right? Like, it's not that easy. I'm not doing it. So I think that's where we're headed to in healthcare. And if you can't meet, that's just table stakes. That's just to show up. So in that context, I think we're trying to learn. And I think the difference is there's a lot of really interesting technology out there that is delivering care in a different way. In general, they're not connected to providers in the four-wall clinics. And I think our commitment is, we talked about our outcomes. We've talked about some processes and balance. And then, we do have 900 clinics, right? We've got almost 3,000 clinicians across the country taking care of patients. So the ability to connect those brick and mortar to the virtual piece, I think, sort of the next horizon for us. And I think we feel strongly the ability to do that is going to set us apart, not the technology alone. There's plenty of great tech out there, but actually, can you empower good clinical care to make it more efficient? Is that a way we can address staffing challenges, right? Can I give a clinic the ability, I think about your clinic, you affect probably 10,000 patients a year, pretty good lick.
Yeah.
But how do you affect more? Could you affect 25,000? You think about your span of clinics and stuff. So I think thinking about the number of patients to touch and not necessarily just who I lay my hands on is a different way to think as therapists. And we'll see where it goes. We're learning. We're leveraging our telehealth team and our remote therapeutic monitoring to begin to understand how to do that and link patients with the right provider at the right time.
To close out, probably the best way to ask this is, you're in your perfect world, Chuck's world, what would we look like as an organization, or what does our future look like, really? I mean, your vision and what you want to bring to us as the Senior Vice President of Clinical Excellence, what do you want us to do?
I think about where I see PT sitting. is actually, in a funny way, it's where I started when I started clinics. So the first clinics I opened in a rural community called Lenore City, Tennessee, I was an outpost for an orthopedic group, right? And they were trying to get into that community. I would go to the high school and take care of the high school. And it's just, I knew everybody in the community. And because of that, I started going down to John Deere and Sea Ray, and I would go hang out at those companies to make sure that those employees had access to care in an early way. And so I, in some ways, it's no different than that. It's just moving PT from what I would call a break glass option when something really bad happens, like, oh, I had an ACL, I had a big surgery, to actually being the first point of care for musculoskeletal. So being primary care of musculoskeletal, that's I firmly believe that's where PT belongs. And so if we're doing that, now all the things we talked about follow behind, right? We're going to deliver care in a different way. We're going to meet patients where they need. It allows therapists to truly practice at the top of their license, to spend time focused on diagnosis and prognosis and plan of care, and then to delegate specific pieces of the care to the right care team. Some of that's me, some of that will be team members that I think allow us to do that. I think if we achieve that, now you've kind of helped reimbursement, you're having the impact on musculoskeletal health you would hope, and found a way to, you know, for physical therapy and ATI to integrate within the larger health ecosystem.
I 100% agree. I think we need to be the tip of the spear, so to speak. We, it, just like athletic trainers are the outreach to PT, we need to be able to provide that direct access so we can then help delegate where patients need to be. So 100% agree with you there. Well, Chuck, thank you again for coming on today. I know you're a busy man, and you, like you said, you're getting ready for the start of the football season, and we're all going to see what happens.
That's right. We got to get the fantasy football teams ready, right?
I know.
Again, I might have to actually pay attention to the Patriots. They've got my guy Drake May, so I know. You know, we'll have to watch, see how that goes.
Well, you can see my boy Larry Bird behind me, right?
That's right. It's hey, look, I've got my Celtic stuff. Don't you worry.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Chuck, thanks again. Appreciate the time.
All right, it's good. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, man.
Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like, comment, and share it on social media. Access all of our episodes on platforms such as Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Stay updated by following us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or visiting our website at ajrsportsscience.podbean.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science for upcoming content. Thank you for tuning in, and stay tuned for our next episode.